All right, so my name's Kirk, and I got this crazy idea to data mine GitHub because a friend of mine was data mining GitHub also. His site is wik-i-pedia, and he's a security researcher. He did a presentation at DEF CON this year, and B-Sides Las Vegas, and he's doing one at DerbyCon, which I think is this month or early next month. And what he did is he downloaded all of GitHub, including the forks, and then generated a password list from it, as well as like a static salt list and all these other things. And the cool part about it is security researchers are going nuts because it's the largest, real-world password list generated from source code ever made. The guy who tried it before did it off Subversion and only did 2,000 repositories. Wik is 2,016 terabytes deep. And he projects that GitHub's like 30 terabytes, but he only does 60 repositories an hour, so he's not actually sure he's ever going to catch up. Whereas I took a slightly different approach, and which I'll mention in the talk. Okay. Google Gadget? Sweet. I'm also going to videotape this in preparation for the keynote talk later. I did the fundamental thing you're not supposed to do. I updated my laptop software and I updated the camera's firmware yesterday. Yeah. What you're not supposed to do is what I tend to do. Okay, so. And then these videos will be both on YouTube and on archive.org if you want to watch the, because they'll be like 60 gigabytes. Because they're all HD. So yeah, if you want the massive versions. All right, sweet. Let's go on. I'll turn the other one on a little later. Okay, so raising utility for documentation by example. Frankly, I had so much information for this talk, like I could give a 3-day talk, all 3 days about this. But I boiled it down to two core ideas. And wait, that's the pointer. So let's start with the first thing. Today is Friday the 13th. You need to keep calm. Don't go swimming, you don't have sex, you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't go out. Don't split up, don't run from the killer. If you trip, get up and run away, and above all else, turn the light on before you enter the dark room. You know, these axe murderers, they're everywhere, especially today. So the two key ideas are how to make your documentation easier to use, and that's a combination of readability, typography, and searchability, because those are the core three things. If they can't read your information, it's not useful. The other thing is knowing where to start. And to boil it down into the simplest idea, think writer's block. Like, oh, I gotta write this documentation. Where am I going? What am I doing? So, writing is hard. Like, this is the general overview of the process. We're pre-writing, writing, drafting, revising, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. That's what pre-writing really entails. Agony, 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 agony. Lots of pain. I mean, seriously, I'm not even going to walk through all this stuff because it's agony. Especially reader feedback. Who loves reading YouTube comments? I know I do. I mean, I get up in the morning, and I look at my videos, and I read those YouTube comments. It makes me feel so great about myself. That people I don't know are esoterically nitpicking and all kinds of crazy junk that was like, that was an accident, but, you know. So yeah, writing is agony. And people think writing is agony, oh, communication's hard. Writing is more about critical thinking. So yeah, the two, how they fit into the plan is pre-writing, think writer's block, and publishing, think does it look good. So I'll start by, this is the 80s. You got your nice big CRT full of lead and a computer that could probably survive a nuclear hit. And I mean, those tables are probably still reinforced. I mean, wow, I used to have a IBM XT with a 20 meg hard drive. I paid extra for that. Agony. This is the modern computer lab. More space, slimmer monitors, you know, technology. Even libraries have changed around. This is the library. All you see in a lot of libraries are just computers, computers, computers. And that's one of the relevant things. Like, technology has changed, okay? Print is dead. Okay, if you are making documentation as the sole goal of making it print, you're failed. Okay, who here has gone to a website and like, oh, this documentation, this form I got to get, and it's in a PDF. Why do that to us? Because, let's be honest, okay, we're all using the web. We use the web every day. This is what the web looks like. We got tablets, we got cell phones, we got Kindles, laptops, we got a Sun workstation there in the back, even though they're all long gone. We got televisions, okay? A lot of documentation really hasn't caught up to this. If you go and it's only in PDF or it's only in a man page, eek. I remember when Ubuntu launched their man pages online, and people went crazy. It's like, oh, I can Google search this stuff now. It's like, yeah, you could search it before. You just hit forward slash. But, you know, things change. So this is one of the APIs to the Internet Archive. This is the full documentation for the API. It's a text file. And I purposely left it at scale in which it came because, except for probably the first few rows, people can't read that. Can you read that in the back?
Nope.
Exactly. Okay. That's part of the problem. Plain text isn't necessarily good enough anymore. It's great for mastering it. It's like when you're writing your content, I recommend you use the thing you are most comfortable with. Vim, Emacs, you know, Ed, Joe. You know, if you're really hardcore, you can just cat those things straight into the file. But text is great. It's a great starting format, and Markdown, being just a slight modification of text, is great to start. But yeah, this is what it looks like in your regular browser window. This is what it looks like on your cell phone. Now, to actually use this, I pull it up, and then I zoom, and then I pinch to zoom, and then I pinch to zoom about 4, 5, 6 times until that's actually readable to me. Now, the problem with that is I think it was last week they released the recent report on, you know, how many devices are activated a day. Android, they activate somewhere like 750,000 devices a day. The current Android ecosystem, which is cell phones and tablets and e-readers, is currently over 1 billion activated devices. Now, based on, you know, these crazy web guys who spent hours and hours correlating this data, they found out that the largest growing segment on the web, and essentially in all computers, is the cell phone market. Because it's not in the United States. We only got, what, between 300 and 400 million people? That's nothing. Think China. Think India. Okay? Every single day, hundreds of thousands of people are getting on the internet. And it's either Android or iOS. And they both kind of have the same browser. So that's what I think of when I see someone's plain text. It just looks like a white forest and crisp in the winter. Can't see anything. You kind of know something's there, but you really can't distinguish what's going on. So this API is actually called WANT. It's just want.archive.org. So WANT is the example I'm going to go from zero to hero on. So it has 34 lines of text. It's only 256 words, which is serendipitous because today is also Programmer's Day, the 256th day of the year, and it's Friday the 13th. I'm totally going to get hit by lightning later. So WANT has a description, it has a request format, it has sample requests with responses. Now, just looking at it like that or like that, it's like, well, there's a little bit of structure here, there's a little bit of structure down there, but they're actually out of order. If you were to write a reference library for that, it's in the wrong order that you needed it. So the first example I'm going to use to show how people are doing this is Twilio. I thought about using Twitter, but you know, they're just doing a $14 billion IPO and I don't need to market for them. So there's a service called Twilio, and they do a lot right for documentation. And the reason why they do a lot right is not because they're closed. It's not because they're proprietary. It's because they're paying someone to do the documentation. That's it. That's all they're doing. That's the only difference between most open source programs and their proprietary competitors. Is the proprietary competitors have so much money invested in it that they will pay someone to do documentation. Now, to be honest, most open source documentation is at least 2 decades behind the closed source world. I mean, come on, the Internet Archive has, they just did an upgrade. They have 26 petabytes of information online. They have multiple fiber drops. They have three different data centers, one in Los Angeles, one in the Netherlands, and one in the New Library of Alexandria. They are a massive site. They are the largest seeder on BitTorrent because every upload to the Internet Archive is automatically put on BitTorrent. They get ridiculous amounts of traffic, and yet their API is a single page written in text. And the guy who helps manage is like, oh yeah, he's like, yeah, we totally need to upgrade that. I'm like, well, why isn't it that way? He's like, they were kind of closed about this. They were a little ashamed of how, you know, they didn't think it was good enough. But we've all been there. Who hasn't written something and then put it on the internet and thought, man, that wasn't good enough. I feel bad. Like, people get, and then instead you get a pull request for like a cool new feature and you feel better about it. I mean, I wish every story of people putting code online ended that way because, frankly, more people need to put more out there. So Twilio, what they do is their documentation is the same. This is a REST API. The Internet Archive thing is a REST API. There's no real difference except they took the time, and like I said, the first thing, they made it look good. It's easy to read. And what they've learned is that when people read on computers or cell phones or tablets, we scan. We're used to being able to search in page. We're used to be able to go through a lot. Like, there are certain, like the ADODB library, it's a cross-database library for PHP. They provide the documentation as both like a book-like format, separated into chapters, and then they have all the documentation in one file. Now, for search geeks, that's awesome. It's all the documentation search. And that's the thing. We've grown so used to that that like now, I don't even know where my cell phone is. You know, I pull out my cell phone, it's like boom, boom, slide up and down. So what Twilio did is they made it easier to scan. First thing, headers. Oh yeah, post the call. And then they say, okay, this is what we can do, and then here is the command. And you know, you just curl this, supply your own value there, as they say, you know, you scroll down, you see the post parameters. But that's the thing. All they did is they didn't change the documentation. They just added white space. They made it easier for us to scan. So I can go up and down this page and be like, oh, that's a parameter. That's a description. Okay, these things are separated here. Okay, that's separated there. Much easier. Yeah, this doesn't load because it's a local save page, but they also provide all those languages, code examples, which I think is fantastic, except they use crazy JavaScript to do it, which totally doesn't work in most places. So that's kind of bad. I wouldn't recommend that. But code examples, good. So Twilio, and they get, you know, X many millions of requests a day. All they did was say, hey, let's lay this out. And people are like, well, how did they get this idea? Not, I want to say everything old is new again, but frankly, there's no old and there is really no new. We're all just kind of iterating on stuff that's existed forever. So if I compare the Twilio and the Internet Archive thing, you see that the core things of your documentation, and this is the minimal. Okay, first is the license. And most people are like, well, no, you need a README, and you've got to put the, no. Okay, there have been six major articles about licensing problems with GitHub over the last year. It has become such a big deal that GitHub added a new feature to automatically include the license when you create the repository. And the reason being is very simple. It doesn't matter if you wrote the best application in the world. If you don't have a code license on it, it's academic. It's not usable. Now people are like, well, I'm just an independent programmer. I'm writing open source. It's like, yeah, that's fine. Go ahead. Build your application on this unlicensed code. That's fine. But we saw it happen twice last year. Two different companies had their employees pull their entire code bases back off of GitHub. It violated company policy. Now, I don't want to build something and then have the rug pulled out from underneath me. I mean, that's just, ugh. So I always say, if you're going to release a program, the first piece of documentation you should have is the license. And it's really a very simple selection. Okay, you are going to release it open. You just have to choose whether it's free for all or whether you want some copyleft protection. Because all the other licenses fit in that scheme. The Apache license just adds patent support, you know, MIT BSD are essentially the same thing. And then you got the GPLs for your copyleft. And then the next thing, which was what most people actually put first, is what it does. Simple description, only needs to be a sentence, maybe two sentences. You know, then you should have an example, how to get help. This blows my mind. You have these amazing projects and they don't tell you where the forms are. They don't tell you if there's a mailing list. They don't tell you, hey, you know, this is the name of the author. This is who you should email. It's like, no, here's some code. And the more I data mine GitHub, the more I realize that it's becoming an endemic problem. Think Sturgeon's Law, 90% of everything is junk. Well, if the simple metric would be, if you have no license, you are of no use on GitHub or anywhere else. I mean, SourceForge has the same kind of problem, Burlesque.de, Google Code. It's an endemic problem. We're seeing more applications and more stuff released with no license. And it's like, well, I can't do anything without a license. And the only reason I'm bringing that up is such a big thing is because, I mean, there's just another article this week. People are beating the drum because they're like, I found libraries. I found solutions. I can't use them. How to get help and then how to contribute. How to contribute's a little harder because you have to, you know, it's like, oh, I have an issue tracker and like, or I take stuff in IRC. It's a little bit harder to decide, especially if you're just throwing it over the wall. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that, but at least put a line in your README and be like, this is thrown over the wall. You know, here's the license, over the wall, go crazy, fork it. You know, encourage people to fork it. Okay, so right now my GitHub miner has done 500,000 repositories. Okay, these are the documentation files in the order that, in terms of most used to least used. Now, that, like the first one, I found 800,000 READMEs. And people are like, well, 800,000, 500, that doesn't work out. But then, like all non-normalized data, you find all the crazy outliers. For example, the Linux kernel has 117 README files. I mean, I'm like, wait, 117 README files? And then you start digging through, it's like, oh yeah, 40 of those are how to use the kernel on different processor architectures. Just instruction sets on how to do that. So yeah, a lot of these accounts are skewed. The Perl programming language has 107 README files. Python, over 100. I mean, projects, and that's, people don't seem to get this. It's like, oh, I put a syntax highlighting library, because I recently contributed code to one of those. It has one document that's the README. And they're like, oh, that's enough. And I'm like, really, that's enough? Oh yeah, no project should need more than one README. I'm like, no project should need more than one README. Yeah, no. But the multiple README thing is kind of complicated, and I think it's a little confusing to end users, but frankly, more documentation or more coverage of documentation is better. But yeah, here's the breakdown. People go to README first, then README text, then the license file. Like I said, this is problematic because even searching inside of all the READMEs listed, you don't get a license count near equal to the amount of projects that you find. So it's not just code without licenses. It's like I put my doc files in GitHub. So, or I have screenshots for a project on GitHub. There's tons of stuff on there that has zero applicability. It's like people are just using it as an external hard drive. So yeah, license, README, license, to-do. To-dos are great. Most projects don't have them. Usage, copying, MIT license. Was the only freestanding license I found that was over 80,000 files. README.markdown changes authors and authors.txt. Authors.txt is 57,000. The top README is like 860,000 to give you a scale of where everything's going. And then there's tons of stuff in between, like POM files for ANT. That's right, it's ANT POM files. And then SSH keys and all kinds of other wonderful goodies that you shouldn't be putting on there anyway. So, yeah, I'm going to skip the GitHub JSON file because it's gigantically huge. Basically, when you do a query against their main repository list, it returns 100 repositories metadata at a time and can get pretty crazy. So, the first thing that you can do, and you don't need to write, and here's the great beauty, you don't have to write it down. You don't have to learn anything new. You don't have to do anything complicated, okay? To have a style guide, all you need is bold, italic, color, and white space. Now, We already do a lot of this stuff. I mean, I don't know about the rest of you, but I like to use color. I like to use color a lot because it makes it easier for the eye to distinguish what's going on. But, you know, projects like Twilio, for example, they have a fully written out style guide, but you don't need that. I mean, you can get by very minimal with just bolding and italic. You don't want to use underline. I learned this from reading, I think it was Everyday Typography. It was one of the typography books. Underlining was originally, you know, the editor has your manuscript and they underline on it with a pen. Now they added that to the, you know, computer typography because, well, people will use it. But frankly, it's never recommended to use underlining because what on the web uses underlining? Hyperlinks. So now you're confusing the end user by having huge sections of underlined material that they think they're trying to click on and they can't, versus what they're expecting with, like, oh, underline, I should be able to click on, or I should be able to go somewhere. So yeah, don't use underline. And plus, there's no semantic value for it. There's no semantic value in print for underlining, so it didn't really pick up anything going online. It's just like, oh, and you can underline. You know? White space, use a little. For a lot of people, I actually recommend use a lot, but then they go crazy. Just use a little. So then, let's flip to the first open source project, Git. Specifically, libgit. Okay, libgit is it is the C reentrant library for working with Git. Microsoft, Google, and GitHub all use it to run the massive backends to all their Git craziness. And let's apply the style guide here. They color-coded the title. They bolded the header sections. They used one line's worth of line space between sections. They color-coded the difference between the function names and what the options are, and then plain text for the description. And then, yeah, so right here, there's an example code call. It returns an int, git checkout head. You feed it a byte stream of the repository, and any checkout options as a struct or as a hash in the scripting languages people think. And then down here, this is one of the key things. Different languages, different, everything does it different. Like programming languages, take Python or take Perl or take Clojure, or I'm not sure about Java, but Ruby, they all do the same thing. They have versioned documentation. So let's say you're using Ruby 1.9.r4. Okay, you can go to their website and look at the documentation for Ruby 1.9.r4. Where a lot of projects, what they'll do is their documentation won't be versioned, so then whatever the documentation is, it's implied it's for the newest version. So you can never actually go backwards to find out, oh, this change or that change. You'd have to dig through a changes file, and most people don't maintain their changes file. Then you have to look for a news file. Well, as you saw on my list, the news file didn't even make it. Oh, why'd you start over? Or no. Wow, that's weird. Yeah. Didn't even make it on there. I mean, we have people who will write a usage file where all they're doing is putting their samples, and you can just stick that in the README in a separate file, but you won't get news or changes. So, yeah. And then, of course, the other key thing about documentation is navigation. Now, the most common thing is you get the big menu. Some people put it on the right, some people put it on the left, some people put it on the top. Doesn't really matter. As long as it's consistent, easy to read, and there. A lot of documentation, not there. So yeah, a lot of the presentation stuff is about usability. So yeah, this page, search engine friendly. Easy to read, easy to print out, looks good on the cell phone, looks good on the tablet. Now, this is fully open source, but they still pay someone to write all the documentation. Because why? Writing's hard, and it sucks. I mean, I kind of like writing documentation, I don't love it. I'm sure if I was paid to write just the documentation, I might love it, but, you know, it's kind of a chore. Okay. So then, what I did is, okay, well, what happens if we took want, that same single text file you saw, what happens if I just apply the style guide? How much easier would it be for you to use, okay? Now look at it. Okay, the Internet Archive. Do we want this book? This API interface is a single endpoint which determines the Internet Archive status on whether or not they need a book for their collection. Books are identified by their ISBN. Okay? Those first two parts, they didn't even have in their original thing. They didn't even have a description for what the API was. It was just like, here's some API. So yeah, that's valuable. I'm sure if I just handed you guys an API, you might use it and you might find it interesting, but you'd still be like, well, what's it used for? So, and then the next thing, headers. H1, H2, H3, H4s. I mean, nothing really special here. And then bolding. These are all GET requests. So I bolded the GET to make sure that you realize that this is a GET request. You know? Same thing we see in Twilio and all the other ones. None of this changes until right there. Just that little piece is what changes. Most of the rest of the content is copy-pasted. It's just realignment changes. So yeah, now when you scan this, you're like, okay, I have the request format. I have the optional parameters. I have a full layout of what the JSON file is going to look like. And then example. And then this is the big difference. Okay, if you are returning payloads through your API, which almost all APIs do, presenting the result in a readable manner makes it much easier for the end user to understand what they're doing. And one way to do that, syntax highlighting. So yeah, this is nicely formatted JSON. It's much easier to match up the fact that this little status field matches that status information right there. Status result description. Status result description. Didn't change anything. All I did was say, hey, take this JSON, print it, save it to my file. Take this JSON, print it, save it to my file. One of the other additions I added was the HTTP response header. If you're documenting a web API, it is always good to not just document, oh, it's REST, or use GET and push, or here's the endpoint. It's also important to say, okay, this is what your HTTP response header is going to look like. Now, for the Internet Archives, this API, they have like six different APIs. For this one, there's nothing special going on. HTTP value, server, date, nothing. Okay, that's pretty plain. It's pretty generic. If you're accessing GitHub, for example, they have a dozen custom headers fields that they receive. And they pass you information that you use to manipulate your next request in the HTTP header. So it's not even in your payload. Like, you'll get a JSON for a repository back, and it'll be, you know, 400 lines long, and it'll have 200 key values, but it will not tell you what the next URL is. That's hidden in the response header. So when you're documenting web APIs, even if your response header is this generic and doesn't do anything special, the developers want to know about it. Oh, complexity. Okay, so if I had to explain knowledge, like what knowledge means, I did this in a previous conference talk, it's really hard because there's a lot to it. So I'd almost say it's cheating, but it's not. Just make a visual. The easiest way to make this determination is to look at it this way. If you have a piece of code and one of your coworkers or one of your friends or someone on the internet is like, hey, you know, how does this work? And your first thought is to go to a whiteboard, you should probably have a diagram for it in your documentation. If you have to draw it on a whiteboard once, make a display of it because other people are going to want to know. So yeah, here's knowledge, okay? Information, explicit knowledge, and tacit knowledge, all those things that build into it, all go to what's called knowledge conversion, which then leads all the way down to wisdom. So yeah, I love it when a plan comes together. What DataMine and GitHub, the big thing it showed me is what users are looking for in terms of content. And that's one of the key things we all want, okay? When we go to read a doc, we don't just want to be like, oh, here's 700 pages of reference material. Or in the olden days, I'm sure a lot of you at one point or another worked in Microsoft shops, you know, they used to have this book set. It's like, oh, you want to use Visual Studio. It's like, here's a book set this big. The Visual Basic guide is 500 pages. The Visual C++ guide is 700 pages. It's like, oh, you want to use our database? Here's another 500-page manual. Crazy stuff. And frankly, as well as that stuff was written, you still had the searchability problem. Yes, you had a table of contents. Yes, you had an index, but you couldn't search in the text. You know, we've been spoiled. Who here doesn't search documentation using a search engine? Yeah, it's ubiquitous. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like 13-year-olds posting photos to Twitter. It's like almost all of them are doing it. Whether it's a good idea or not, it's not. So one of the key things I said is, okay, well, you know, knowing what these files are is good, but what's in them? Like, what is what they want? Now, this I basically made it into a list. So I like to think of it as Mad Libs. You take the list, you paste it as the boilerplate into your documentation, and then you just fill it out. And that's the thing. You don't have to fill all of it out, because if it's not applicable, it's good to just be like, hey, this part isn't applicable. You don't need to worry about this. So what did I find that people want and look for? The first thing, if you have more than four items in your README or in any document, you need a table of contents. People, yeah, they'll scan your 23 pages or your one page or whatever, but having it right at the top where it's just like, boom, section, there we go. Because one of the things that's not good about documentation, and this is all technical documentation itself, and this isn't just an open source thing, is people like to use their own jargon. And we see this most when marketing speak. Synergy! And, you know, and we got to pivot. Oh, my company's got to pivot. All it does is pivot all day long. We're a fast, lean startup, and we pivot, and we change, and, you know, we're going to be the next something that makes money, and we don't even know what we're doing. Okay, we see this all the time. I mean, come on, dude. Twitter just announced their IPO at $14 billion. I think it was $14 billion because they can only support like 140 characters, and they're probably just cutting off like all those other zeros. I'm like, yay, it's 140. One of the other web developers says, oh no, they're doing it that way so that $14 billion and then people can only buy stock at $140. So it makes it easier for them to parse out how many shares they have. But yeah, table of contents, jargon, ugh. I don't have it in here. It's actually way back here. Sentence structure, formatting, spelling, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it's in the drafting and writing stage. Word choice. If you have a chance to use jargon, don't. If you have to use jargon, please define the term at least once, at least the first time you use it, so that a user who's not necessarily comfortable with, you know, your brand new interactive multi-tiered data streaming service that's really just HTTP with their own custom headers, yeah, please don't do that. The users are not going to like it, and the thing is, it's faster for a user to skip your project and go on to something else than it is for them to learn anything about your code and use it. That's the harshest truth in the open source world. People don't like to hear that, but they do. There are 47 syntax highlighting libraries and applications. I know this because I had to go through all of them to find a good one to do multi-language syntax highlighting. The best solution was the one that sounds the craziest. You load it into Vim, and then you use a Vim plugin to export the Vim syntax highlighting to an HTML file, because all the JavaScript libraries, with the exception of two of them, for example, can't correctly parse Perl. And people are like, well, it's just Perl's crazy. C++ has the exact same problem. C++ has the inherently unparsable thing once you start getting into templates and C++ 11. So it's like, well, that just limits everything you're trying to use, because one of my later examples, Qt, they wrote the whole thing in C++. They needed to do syntax highlighting. Most every single solution out there did not fit what they needed. So yeah, table of contents, more than 3 to 5 items, more than one page in length, stick that right at the top. Project name, wow. GitHub is totally kind of corrupting people, because you load the GitHub page, it's got the repo at the top and everything looks great, and then they don't tell you what the name of the project is. Or they don't even have a README. And it's like, well, that's great, but is the repository name the project name, or is it just something cutesy that they came up with? You know, unknown. Why, you don't want your user to have unknowns. The easiest way to think of the user is they want the answer as fast as possible, period. Now, granted, some of us like learning more in depth. Some of us know that knowing more in depth helps. But frankly, most users are not like that. Description, one or two sentences. Version, this goes a little bit into versioning your docs. If you have multiple stable versions of something, you might as well include the version number in your documentation so people know which one's referring to. Usage, sometimes called synopsis, sometimes called examples. Some projects like rsync, Git, there's a few other ones. Python, Django, Apache, they don't just have simple usage things, they have cookbooks. Like, you have a man page that's a cookbook that's like, here's 80 different ways to just get going. Very useful. The more sophisticated your program gets, the more you kind of need that. Required arguments. This we see is already implied in most man pages. You either see it as command name, bracket, what you need, options. I'll give you a quick example. Oh, yeah, I know. Okay, so let's do man rsync. Yes, I'm sure a lot of people used to seeing this. So they delimit it right here, right in your synopsis. They have these are the options, and then this is what's required. Now, destination is technically optional on a lot of these things because it'll automatically dump to your current directory. But yeah, the host and source are not. And then in man pages, even in good man pages, there's white space. Space between there, highlighted header section names. I actually prefer to write my source material in Markdown because Markdown, being so trivially simple, has converters to man pages. It has converters to HTML. You can automatically convert man to PDF. I mean, it's great, and it's also better for you. If you have to write documentation, you don't want to write it in tech. Okay, people are like, oh, but I can, I can lay this out, it's beautiful, and I can have my two spaces after the period even though it's completely wrong, you know? Yeah, it's like, yeah, that's fine, but then you can't really grep it. You have to use tech grep. Because if you grep a pattern that happens to match your tech layout, you're going to get hundreds of lines of stuff that you didn't want. No. I like to keep it simple. I think people should do it simple. Plain text or Markdown. Okay, options, you have diagnostics. This is something a lot of people leave off. And it also fits in with error code. If you write a command line application, there should be a section that tells the user what the return status is. It can't just be implied, this is successful and this is failure. What if you have more than two options? There are plenty of command line applications that have like 15 different return codes based on what happens. So yeah, return codes are valuable. Configuration environment. If you have to change the environment to run your application, there needs to be a note in the documentation about it. Dependencies. It's actually gotten simpler. Like Ruby, you can just be like gem blah, Perl cpan blah, Python pip blah. It's gotten a lot easier. It's not like building OpenOffice in 2002 was like set five different environment variables and then untar and then run configure and then set a prefix directory and then run make, blah 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 blah. Now, if you're on Red Hat, it's just yum install OpenOffice. Or if you're on Debian, it's aptitude install LibreOffice. If you're on OpenSUSE, it's zipper install. A lot of this has been boiled down, but at the same time, you don't make assumptions about how advanced your user is. If you're going to make any assumptions, you say, okay, they are this level beginner. You never say, oh, they're better than that, because it'll always come back to bite you. And there's no real good way to explain this, so the best way I've heard it said is anything that you think is obvious is not necessarily obvious to everyone else. And that was like a hard lesson for me personally, writing docs. I'm like, oh, that's obvious. Like, I don't need to put that in there. And then wrong. She has dependencies. Like, a lot of this stuff is literally like two lines of writing, one line of writing, one line of writing. Incompatibilities, you hardly need this section ever, but if you're, like, if version one is not compatible with version two, you need a little something in there about it. Why did that do it that way? Okay, and then the other half, bugs and limitations. If there are known bugs, you should have a list of authors or contributors. And this is a big deal. This is one of the things, this, authors and contributors, and license and copyright. Okay, copyright's pretty easy to understand. It's implied that whoever wrote it has the copyright. Okay, the license, which is also a piece of documentation, that tells us what we, as the users, can do with it. But then there's also the bugs and limitations, then there's also the authors and contributors. And there was recently a huge spat about this because GCC released a new version. So they put out big mailing list letters being like, you know, here's the new version of GCC and here's what we did. And then the huge cop-out came right at the end where it's like, we would like to thank all of our contributors. There are too many to name. It's like, wait, so you had how many hundreds of contributors and you couldn't bother to copy their names out of the contributor file and paste it into an email? Oh wait, that's right, they don't necessarily maintain that correctly. Okay, great, easiest way to burn potential developers, don't give them credit for what they did. You want to get people off your project, remove their name right out of it. People think this is, you know, why get worked up over this? Because there are a lot of people, myself included, who for years, you contribute to open source problem, you went crazy, you're like, did they like it, did they not like it? Like, oh no, they haven't responded to my email in 2 days. Like, they're ignoring me. Who hasn't thought they've been ignored in email before? Yeah.
It's even worse because it's a resume item.
Exactly. There are, I mean, what happens, because this I've seen this happen, what happens when you're working for a company and the company says, okay, we want you to update this open source application and release the code, go for it. And they give you no other thing. Well, that it's like, okay, well, I'm getting paid to do this. So I go and add this huge feature, and then they don't say, oh, this was contributed by Kirk, or this was contributed by Phil, or this was contributed by Pat. They just say, oh, well, some contributor passed this along. No, no, no. I mean, some people say it's an ego thing. It's about respect, okay? If you're going to accept community contributions, you need to let people know that these other people are involved. Example, that's a gimme. Who doesn't like examples? Installation instructions, yes. Reporting bugs. A lot of projects leave that out. They make the assumption, oh, it's on GitHub. You'll just file a GitHub issue. That's not necessarily the case. There are plenty of projects who host their code on GitHub who have a Bugzilla somewhere else, who have a request tracker somewhere else, with, you know, tens of thousands of, you know, closed bugs in history that they can't just move to GitHub. Frankly, I've worked on some projects that are recently moving to GitHub, and converting issues to GitHub is extremely painful, especially when there's more than like four or five. Getting help. If the user's got your app and they're reading your documentation, you might as well tell them where they can get more help. Change logs get ignored. Contributor files get ignored. README.operating system, that crops up a lot. And it's a convention that the GNU guys came up with way back in the day. It's real simple. If anything is different about running on a different architecture, you do README.architecture processor type. So, you know, i386, or it's ARMv7, or it's MIPS, or, you know, Spark v4. So the next example I want to show of which I think Qt might actually have the highest quality documentation open source I've seen, is Qt. Qt is crazy because I'm not sure how many people here know how Qt started, but basically it started at a company and it had a crazy funky license that like made it hard for people to use for years and years and years. And then one day, you know, they're like, oh, we're going to make this a real open source license and get more people involved. And they did that, and Qt runs on Windows, and it runs on Linux, and it runs on Mac, and it'll run on your iOS phone, and it'll run on your BlackBerry, and it will run on your Android. You know, it runs a lot of places. But at the same time, Qt has maintained this wonderful, wonderful documentation. And like I said, we see the same hallmarks, you know, navigation, boom, right side. This is code, one line, include objects. This is what it's inherited by. These are all links. It would actually be a little better if they either highlighted or underlined, but you know, color coding them different, having the little pointer finger is kind of enough. And yeah, we scroll down. They use combinations of tables, color coding, and bolding to let you know, okay, well, this is an object type, and this is a function name. And this looks kind of hairy. I mean, this is all C++. You get kind of crazy in supplying parameters to functions, you know. But yeah, let's say I just wanted to punch plus. Yeah, void delete later, boom. You know, oh, I want to do some signal work. Okay, well, I can just destroy it and pass it the object, or I can do with the object name change by passing in that. You know, white space, color coding, and we're seeing the same sections we see in other things. Title, you know, subsection, inherited by, a note, okay, properties, public functions, public slots, signals, protected functions, related non-members, macros, detailed description. The other reason I use Qt is, you know, even though we do, a lot of us deal with web APIs and stuff, a lot of us still deal with traditional libraries, and Qt is extensive in its documentation of as a traditional library. So yeah, if you're, pick any language you want. You know, this could just easily as be, you know, a Python thing where it's like, oh no, this function is going to return a dictionary of X many terms after you pass in, you know, a class and another data type. Man pages, I already showed you some man pages. And now questions before I head back into a couple of the examples. Oh yeah, I see it, Bill. Any questions about, I beat up the visibility and the searchability a lot. So let's go into what people are looking for in documentation. Does anyone have any questions about what they want in a document? Or what they need that they hadn't heard of? Was mentioned. Nothing? Okay. Well, I'll show you one or two more great examples. And that's the thing. It's documentation. It's not creative writing. Okay? Creative writing is really hard. You have to come up with characterization. You have to come up with different voices for the characters. You have to set a tone for your story. You have to pick a setting, a time frame. You know, what's your master plot going to be? I'm not sure if people are familiar with it. Master plot is the idea that there are, I think there's like 35 or 36 master plots where all fictional stories fit into one of those core structures. So technically, creative writing is just people copying the same structure over and over and over. All they do is put a different twist on it. Okay, technical writing is much easier. Okay, a boilerplate is literally just my two slides of this is what the user is looking for based on X many millions of, well, right now it's only half a million projects, but it's eventually going to balloon up to the 5.2 million is GitHub's current count. It was 5 million a few months ago, but every time that they go up another 100,000, it kind of spirals out of control because people can, you know, GitHub makes it easy to fork. All on the website, fork. You know, boom, all it is a fork. There's nothing to it. It's a one-click operation. And that's also one of the problems with working with GitHub data is that, take jQuery, for example. jQuery is very popular. jQuery is, you know, pretty synonymous on the web. You know, it solves a lot of ickiness of JavaScript. What's one of the problems with jQuery? You go to their GitHub page and they have X many thousands of forks. But then if you actually dig through the forks, a thousand of those forks are nothing. They have no changes or they're out of date compared to the main code base. So, you know, that's a huge searchability problem. Part of how jQuery mitigates it is if you use the they have tags, so you can actually check out previous versions, and then you get the version control data with it. You know, jump back down. Technical writing, like, okay, that's weird. It's not showing me. Yeah, you guys can see that. Interesting how it's not, like, refreshing my slides. Very interesting indeed. Yeah. So basically, these two slides are your structure. Technical documentation, whether it's open source or closed source software, it's all the same thing. What it is, can I use it, aka licensing, who built it, authors and contributors, and how does it work? That comes, there's your example, there's your reference manual. See, man pages, when man pages first came out, way back in the day, like before I was born, the idea of a man page was pretty simple. It was a reference, but it was assumed that the audience using it was very technical. You know, list packers at MIT, and guys dropping LSD at Berkeley, you know, like, oh, we gotta create this unit's operating system, hold on, like, do the really heavy drugs, and then do this. Okay, that was expected back then. Now, you know, my mom is in her 70s and uses Linux. Okay? And at the same time, there are 6-year-olds and 10-year-olds using Android Linux or using a tablet. You know, computing is so synonymous now that the assumptions about where and who the documentation for has changed. The other big thing about documentation is it's not just the reference manual. The reference manual is one part. The user manual. Most software doesn't actually have a user manual, but the easiest way to equate it is if you bought a smartphone brand new, you get a manual with it. That's the user manual. User manual is about what it is and how for a complete novice to use the device. Diagrams are documentation. Tutorials, walkthroughs are documentation. Guides on different independent ideas of your project are documentation. It's no longer just, hey, let me spit out a README or let me do one man page and it's done. We have a much larger audience and they're going to consume it on the web, so you got to fill it in. Like I said, it's a simple structure. Take these, fill out what you need, skip what you don't, and you're done. Now, yes, you still have to compose sentences and do all the critical thinking to get your ideas together, but frankly, I think it's much easier to have a checklist. And the thing is, it's not really changing per software type. Whether you're releasing a library or a web-based REST API or a command line application or an entire operating system, people always want the same thing. What it is, how can I use it, where can I use it? And these, let's flip back to the other page. Yeah, this is what it boils down to. First page, I think, are the most important things. And then the second page is a lot of things I've discovered that people want that is left out. But yeah, writing documentation can be very simple. Just plug and play. Mad Libs. Oh, my example, rsync dot blah blah blah, done. Does anyone have any questions about that? I mean, I can't really think of a simpler way for technical people to do it other than just plugging and playing. The only advice left I can give you is don't be afraid. It doesn't matter if you make spelling mistakes. It doesn't matter if you make grammar mistakes. Okay? Yes, there might be some crazy grammar knots that pop out of the woodwork. It's a bit of a snarky pull request, but frankly, who cares? The users are going to love documentation for your project, and they may not say it, but they want that just as much as they want your code. All right, that's it. Oh, if someone have a question, I'll just say. I thought I heard someone start to speak up when I ended.
Yeah, I said absolutely, you're right. Without documentation, you can't use the code well.
Yeah, and that's the last thing. Don't ever tell your users, oh, just read the code. That is the worst thing to blow off a user possible. It's like, oh, like I said, if you don't want contributors, don't credit them. If you don't want users, read the code.
The documentation is in the code.
Oh yeah, doc strings are terrible. It's like, let me write one line of comment and then auto-generate that and then give you no explanation about it.